Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke, and today we're coming to you from the state capitol in Pierre for the first week of the 2015 legislative session. And yesterday, in a joint session of the House and Senate, South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice David Gilbertson delivered his State of the Judiciary address, and he's with us here. And Chief Justice Gilbertson, thanks for joining us again on Dakota Midday.
You're welcome.
My first question is, do other chief justices around the country also deliver State of the Judiciaries?
I think they're all a little bit different. Some of them don't deliver it to a joint session of the legislature. It might be at a bar meeting. Some of them simply send in written reports. I would happen to be in North Dakota last week and heard their chief justice give his State of the Judiciary to the North Dakota legislature. The governor came, very similar to ours, but every state probably does it a little bit differently.
Well, among the things you talked about was the overhaul of the state's criminal justice system, which happened a couple of years ago. That was the Public Safety Improvement Act. You've now had, about 18 months of experiences with the alternative sentencing and the other things in that act. What have you seen so far?
Well, it's gone very well. We have now had 300 people enrolled in the program. That's 300 people that were sentenced to the penitentiary and 300 people that had a second chance. And most of them did very well in the program or are still in the program doing well. A few unfortunately failed. But the report of the Oversight Committee said that if this program had not been adopted 2 years ago, that right now we would be building two new penitentiaries. And as the governor reported this week, the penitentiary population is flat. It's not going up anymore. And if this state had to pay for two new penitentiaries, depending on their size and whether you're going maximum security, it could have been $250 million for the two prisons. And that doesn't even include staffing them 24/7. So the fact that these people are in this alternative sentencing program, drug court, alcohol court, they're back in the community, they are required to hold employment or full-time education, is a much better result for the taxpayers than having to pay for two new penitentiaries, staff them, and fill them with prisoners.
Do you have examples of situations where this is, you know, someone has gone through the alternative sentencing or have gone through the drug and alcohol courts that where this has actually worked and benefited them?
Yes, I've been able to speak at several graduations of drug and alcohol courts, and one thing I really enjoy doing is before the graduation starts is sit down and visit with the graduates, and they all have very compelling stories. One person looked me in the eye and said, if it wasn't for this program, I'd be dead by now. Another person said, you need divine intervention to get off drugs. My divine intervention came in the form of a squad car, which is a little humor to it. And another graduate said that prison doesn't teach you how to live in society on your own. Drug and alcohol courts do that.
Is that really, along with the money that is saved, that really the most beneficial thing to the alternative sentencing in these drug and alcohol courts is being able to, you know, allow people to learn how to make it in society, how to reform themselves and change their lives?
Sure, because if not, we're going to get them back again. These people are going to be released from prison, and those that are addicted are still addicts when they're released. Well, guess what? They keep coming back into our system. They get caught again and again and again. At one point, it was estimated that over 50% of the people being released from our penitentiaries were coming back to the penitentiaries, and in large part because they were addicts, either to alcohol, drugs, or both.
Where is the state at right now regarding the drug and alcohol courts? There's also the veterans courts. Some of these were pilot projects. Are there more courts that are in the process?
Yes, there are. In fact, we have a master plan that would be completed in probably about 5 years. This year we started a drug court in Mitchell. We started an alcohol court in Aberdeen. And we started the Veterans Court, a pilot project in Watertown, the first in our state. And we also started our first pilot project of a HOPE program. There's addiction in rural areas, and drug and alcohol courts don't work in rural areas because there's a component that requires regular visits to counseling. Well, it's not available in a Falkton or a Selby. So what we've done is taken a program that started in Hawaii, and we did a pilot project up in the Selby-Mobridge area. Judge Scott Myron, who's in charge of it, tells me that they've had, it's full, the people in it are doing well, three have already graduated, and that's, again, 15 people who were sentenced to the penitentiary but didn't serve that time at taxpayer expense because of this alternative program.
We were talking with Governor Dugard about proposals for the reform of the juvenile justice system. You talked about it in your State of the Judiciary address yesterday as well. Is the model for youth then built on the success that you've seen with the adult criminal justice system reform?
In most respects, but not all respects, and that's because you treat juveniles differently than you treat adults. Juveniles, you're trying to reform them and get their behavior back into a mode that makes them into positive citizens. Adults, there's a punishment component to part of it, but you still want to rehabilitate them. And the juveniles only can go till they're 18, and then they're generally, you know, the juvenile system doesn't handle them anymore. They would then go into the adult system. One of the major problems that we have had in the juvenile system, and I found this firsthand, first when I was a prosecutor for 10 years and then later as a circuit judge, is that in many areas, the judge is faced with two limited choices when he gets a juvenile in his or her court. One is you can put them on probation back in the community. The problem with this is all too often it does not provide adequate supervision, and so the juvenile goes out and does the same delinquent acts again and again. The only other option is, okay, if that didn't work, you send them to an institution, and the institutions are extremely expensive. Our one group home in the Black Hills to send a juvenile there costs nearly $150,000 a year for one child, and this is three times the cost of sending an adult to maximum security sections in the state penitentiary. The other problem you have is oftentimes this juvenile is living in a family situation that is probably, I just use the word, horrible. And it doesn't do a lot of good to try to reform the juvenile if they're going back into this family sewer once they're released. So you have to not only work with the juvenile, you've got to work with the juvenile's family. And under this new proposal, there's a significant sum of money for counseling for both the juveniles and the family to try to get both of them functional.
So part of this is finding what diversion is that the right word, or you know what is this new option that you're offering?
The new option is basically to keep the juvenile in the community, but having more services available to try to deal with the problems of the juvenile and the juvenile's family, not just simply saying you're on probation, behave yourself or else.
Okay. Now, are the models here for juvenile justice reform, or are you looking at things that have worked in other states as well? Are there other states' models that you've drawn from?
My understanding is yes. We got some valuable assistance from the Pew Foundation, and they have been active in many states, both on the adult and juvenile side. And I think they came with some ideas, and then the work group the governor referred to then looked at South Dakota's needs and tried to come up blending what's been done in other states with what our specific needs are for our state. We just didn't buy something off the shelf.
Moving on to something else that you talked about in your State of the Judiciary address yesterday, you said the silver tsunami of elder abuse should be the next major issue addressed by the governor, legislature, and court system. How much elder abuse is there in South Dakota?
The short answer is we don't know. And the simple reason is, as I said yesterday, only 1 in 14 cases of elder abuse are ever discovered or found out. So I'm assuming, based on that national statistic, that there's a lot more in South Dakota than we suspect. that's the hard part. We know how many people commit felonies. We know how many juveniles commit delinquent acts. But when you look at the elder abuse issue, you're kind of groping in the dark, really, because you don't know the size of the problem or where it's at. You see these commercials on TV all the time where this con man is just literally laughing because he's just ripped off some elderly person over the internet. Well, I'm not trying to downplay that, but that's only 10% of the problem. 90% of the elder abuse occurs from perpetrators in the victim's own family. It's not from some con man you see on TV.
Are we talking? You mentioned the con man on TV. That's taking advantage of financial situations. Are we talking both financial abuse as well as physical abuse
and emotional abuse?
And emotional abuse,
right?
And how do you tackle that then? These three different parts of that.
Well, it's not as easy in a way as it would be like the adult reforms we did in the criminal or the juvenile. It's got to be a more piecemeal type approach, because it's not like you can just dial up a master plan and say, okay, next week we're going to attack all elder abuse. You have to identify the problem. You have to figure out where it's at. That might be the hardest part about it, is identifying who's being abused and where are they. And then you can start asking the second question, what are we going to do about it?
And what are we going to do about it? Is that what's being discussed right now?
I think that's a bit premature. I just raised the issue. I mean, I raise issues, but I don't always have solutions. A couple years ago, I talked about no attorneys in rural areas raising the issue. Now we're doing something about it. I talked about a pilot program for drug courts, I think, for the first time in 2006. Now, we're well on our way to addressing it statewide. This problem is still in the discussion stages. We could look at what other states have done. I know that other states are working on it. The Conference of Chief Justices, which I belong to, is very active in this area. They are trying to identify, how large a problem do we have. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be determined as larger than we suspected or want it to be.
Now, you mentioned the efforts to get more rural attorneys practicing in South Dakota. Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute or so here. At this point, I believe you announced yesterday that you've had some success in those efforts?
Right. We have 7 counties now where we've placed attorneys. We are allowed to go up to 16, and quite frankly, we are ahead of schedule.
And what does it take to get young law students or maybe experienced practicing lawyers to come to South Dakota and work in those rural areas?
I think that you have to convince them that there's a good life out there, that they can have an active professional career as an attorney in these areas, and that, quite frankly, a lot of the larger areas are overpopulated with attorneys. And so far we've had excellent success. And the 7 counties are not grouped into one area of the state. They're all over the state. And we are very close in a couple other counties with getting agreements between the counties and the attorneys. We are having our best luck with looking in their own backyards. Law students want to go home, but not always.
Finally, the other things that you talked about yesterday, quickly here, moving to electronic filing. You're able to take care of more things online, so does that speed things up and save time and money perhaps as well?
All three. Uh-huh. We did spend some significant dollars to get the system set up, but we were literally drowning in paper. And the caseloads are going up, which means more paper. So the solution was to go electronically. I think virtually every state in the country is going that way with their court system.
All right. Well, Chief Justice, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and talking with us again on Dakota Midday.